Welcome to this, the first plenary session of the 21st Annual Law and Religion Symposium here at Brigham Young University Law School. My name is Brett Scharfs. I'm an Associate Dean here at the Law School and Associate Director of the International Center for Law and Religion Studies. And I would like to join our university president, Kevin Worthen, and our dean, Jim Rasband, who welcomed you yesterday and welcome you here today as well. This morning, in this plenary session, we're going to be discussing different versions of secularism, hence the title Secularisms, Religion, and Social Tension. We have four speakers. We have bios in the materials, so I'm just going to introduce them by name now, and then each will speak for approximately 20 minutes, and then we will have questions and answers at the close of their remarks. When it comes time for questions and answers, there will be some students with microphones, and it's important that I, as chair, recognize the next question and that you ask questions into the microphone. This is because our interpreters, who are interpreting into about a dozen different languages, are located in a different room. And if we're not each speaking into the microphone, then there's a breakdown in the translation. If you are asking your question in a language other than English, there will be a three-way translation. The interpreters will translate your question into English, and then it will be retranslated into all of the other languages. What this means is that, first, questions need to be brief, succinct, and to the point. And secondly, relatively simple and straightforward. Communicating is difficult under the best of circumstances, and when we get into three-way interpretation, we have to be very generous and kind with each other in order to facilitate successful communication. We are all very happy to be here with old friends, new friends, with people from so many different places, so many different languages, so many different cultures, so many different legal systems. The organizing principle of this symposium is that we can learn much by doing three things. One is bringing people together from many different places, not just from one or two regions of the world, but literally bringing people from many places together. Secondly, we believe that something interesting can happen when we bring different types of groups together, academics, religious leaders, and government officials. It is no accident that we try to bring important thought leaders from each of these categories together, because oftentimes there are good conversations that take place within these categories. Religious leaders engage in interreligious dialogue. Government leaders have government-to-government contacts quite frequently. And academics, of course, we get together and talk and talk and talk. But what happens less is bringing these three groups together. The third thing that we believe is important is bringing people of many different languages together. You heard last night from our university president that BYU prides itself on being one of the leading universities in the world for teaching foreign languages. And if you ever go to the United Nations, you'll see that there are official translations into about four languages. When we attempt 12, as you can imagine, we sometimes fall short. But our intention and our hope is that you will receive world-class interpretive services and also very nice informal assistance from our students along the way. So we genuinely hope that the Tower of Babel, which is the world in which we live, can be converted to a place where we can listen and understand and communicate freely with each other. Well, The speakers we have this morning, I think, will be a wonderful springboard and build upon the opening plenary address that we had from Senator Hatch yesterday evening. I was pleased that Senator Hatch focused his fire upon himself, upon the United States and the situation here, rather than elsewhere. I think each of our willingness to assess critically and to think critically about not just problems in other places, but problems in our own homes, was an example that he set for us yesterday evening. Our first speaker is an old friend and one of the leading sociologists of law and religion in the world. Brian Grimm is the president of the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation here in the United States. He will speak first. We'll then hear from Slavica Jakelic. She is associate fellow at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture at the University of Virginia. That's one hat. And also an assistant professor of humanities and social thought in the Honors College at Valparaiso University in the United States. We have good friends at Valparaiso, and so we're happy to meet Slavica as well. Third, we will hear from Akinola Ibidapo Obe, professor and dean of the Faculty of Law at the University of Lagos in Nigeria. And finally, from Daniel Philpott, a famous American professor of political science and peace studies from the University of Notre Dame, from the Center for Civil and Human Rights at Notre Dame. My plan as moderator will be simply to ask our speakers to speak for no more than 20 minutes or so, and that will leave us with plenty of time for questions and conversation at the end. Brian?
Thank you, and good morning. I think my talk serves as an introduction to the world of information that we'll be discussing from many different viewpoints today. I'll be sharing data from a project that I helped lead for almost a decade at the Pew Research Center with the Pew Templeton Global Religious Futures Project. My study has focused primarily on religious freedom and showing how, when religious freedom is respected, that you have better outcomes. You have lower violence, more harmony, better economies, better lives for women. But that's a different talk than I'm giving today. Today I'm going to focus on the global religious landscape, the level of religion in the world, the level of secularism, or at least a measure of that, people who have no particular affiliation, and then religious diversity, and whether religious diversity is good or bad for societies and the world. So first, the question, how do we measure religious affiliation? Well, it's somewhat simple. We just ask you, what's your religion, if you have any? And then you say. So this study is a compilation of more than 2,000 surveys and censuses around the world, and the basis of the data comes from these surveys and censuses. The results show that more than 8 in 10 people today have a faith. And even among the 16% of people who do not have a particular faith, many of them still have some religious beliefs or engage in religious practices. So religion is a pervasive and, as I'll mention in a few minutes, growing phenomenon in the world. So who are these religious believers around the world? The largest group are Christians. They make up about a third of the world's people. And 100 years ago, most Christians lived in Europe. 75% of Christians lived in Europe. Today, 74% of Christians live outside of Europe. Christianity is no longer a European religion, it's a global religion. About half of all Christians are Catholic, my faith. The rest are divided into other groups, Orthodox Christians, Protestant, Pentecostal, and a variety of other faiths, such as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Islam is the second largest faith, numbering 1.6 billion people. Before I did this study, there were no good numbers of the size of the Muslim population. If you go to the Saudi Arabian Hajj website, they cite these numbers as the global population of Muslims today. They make up about a quarter of the world's people. But Islam is not an Arab religion. It's not a Middle Eastern religion. Islam, most Muslims live outside of the Middle East and North Africa. 80% of Muslims live outside of the Middle East. So Islam is also predominantly an Asian religion. More than 60% of Muslims live in Asia. There are two main groups within Islam, Sunni and Shia. Sunni are the largest, making up about between 87 to 90%. Shia are between 10 and 13% of global Islam. Now, the third largest religious group are the religiously unaffiliated. They're not really a group, but taken together, there are about 1.1 billion people, or 16% of the world's population, who, when asked, say, "I have no particular faith," or "I have no faith." Some of these can be atheists, some can be agnostic, but this is the number. Many of these people still have religious beliefs. For example, in the United States, among people with no particular faith, the unaffiliated, 68% of American unaffiliated believe in God. In France, a third of people with no faith believe in God. So still among this unaffiliated, you still find religious beliefs and practices. Now, only 12% of the religious unaffiliated live in Europe. Where do the rest live? Well, 76% of people with no faith live in Asia. Well, that's largely driven by one country, China. About half of China's population has no particular faith or no faith. But even among them, many of them still pray to their ancestors. So there's still some belief there. Now, so 62% live in China. Now, notice, where do the unaffiliated live? Mostly in China and Europe. China has a one-child per family policy. China's population is not growing. They're aging. Europe does not have a one-child per family policy, but they practice one-child per family. So their population is not growing. What does this mean? Well, Asia, the Americas, Latin America, Asia outside of China, and sub-Saharan Africa are having many children. So the future of the world will become more religious. The religiously unaffiliated, on average, are 34 years old. That's much older than Muslims, who are on average 23 years old. And older than Hindus, Christians, and other religions. So when you have a population who is younger, that means more people are having children. So these populations will grow. We'll have a study coming out later this year, even showing when we take into account conversion, that the religious population of the world is going to grow in the coming decades. Religion will become a more and more important topic, so issues of religious freedom and tolerance will, of course, become more important. The next largest group are Hindus. Hindus are about 15% of the world, but Hindus mostly live in Asia and mostly live in India. So 94% of all Hindus live in India, so even though Hinduism is a large religion, it's very concentrated mostly in one country. Buddhism is the next largest religion, making 7% of the world's population. Again, most Buddhists live in Asia, And where do most Buddhists live? Half of all Buddhists live in China, making China the largest Buddhist country in the world. It's also the largest unaffiliated country in the world. It's also the seventh largest Christian population, has the seventh largest Christian population in the world. In China, it's filled with non-believers and filled with believers. It's, as I'll say later, one of the most diverse countries. Folk religion, these are local religions practiced that are not attached to a global religion. They number 6% of the world's population. Again, most live in Asia. And 73% of all folk religionists live in China. China has the largest folk religious population of any country. Other faiths make up only 1%. Zoroastrianism, Baha'i, Shintoism, all of these are relatively small in number. Most live in Asia. And then finally, the last world religion is actually very small, but it's had global impact. Judaism numbers only 14 million people, less than 0.2% of the world's people are Jewish. 10% live in Europe. And where do the rest of Jewish people live? Two places. Yes. 82% live in the United States and Israel. And there's a debate whether or not more Jews live in Israel or more Jews live in the United States. I don't know. It's very close. 41% of Jews live in each one. Now, this gives you an idea of the global religious landscape. Now, how diverse our countries, or how diverse is our world? So how can we measure diversity? Let me give an example from Indonesia. In Indonesia, 87% of people are Muslim, 10% are Christian, 2% are Hindu, and another few percent are Buddhists and some other faiths. So by this measure, Indonesia is not very diverse. It's mostly Muslim. However, diversity is not the same thing as pluralism. I will talk about diversity, a numeric measure of diversity, but pluralism is when you have the activity of many different faiths and practices involved in society. At least that's how I can think of pluralism. So you can find many different faiths and much religious activity in Indonesia. If you go to Bali, it's not Muslim, it's Hindu. So you certain parts of Indonesia, you find much diversity or much pluralism, but relatively low diversity. So looking at religious diversity, we can see four country examples to give an idea of how I measure religious diversity. Singapore is the most religiously diverse country in the world today based on these eight religious groups. Singapore has large Christian, Muslim, unaffiliated Hindu, Buddhist populations, as well as a collection of other faiths and folk religionists. So of all the countries in the world, this is the most diverse mixture of these religions. So we consider Singapore having very high religious diversity. France is an example of a country that has high religious diversity because the largest group, Christians, make up only about 63%. So around 60% is one religion, and then the rest is divided into two other faiths, Islam making up about 8%, and the religiously unaffiliated making up 28%. So you can think of that as high religious diversity in a global comparison. The United States, by contrast, has moderate religious diversity looking at these eight religions, because almost 80% of Americans identify as Christian, and the only other large group in the United States are the unaffiliated, making up 16%. However, remember, if we think of pluralism, the United States is very pluralistic, because within Christianity we have We have every kind of Christian imaginable, you know, Baptists and Methodists and Presbyterians and every kind of Catholics and Orthodox, very active faith in the United States. And then the Muslim community is very visible. The Jewish community is very visible. So we have a lot of pluralism, but diversity-wise, you know, it's mostly Christian population. And then a country like Egypt has low religious diversity. By surveys, only 5% of Egypt are Christian, and the rest are Muslim, 95%. Some estimates say the Christians may be as many as 10%. But still, Egypt's an example of low diversity. So how does do the regions of the world rate in terms of diversity? The world, as I mentioned at the beginning, is about 32% Christian, 23% Muslim, 16% unaffiliated, 15% Hindu, 7% Buddhist, and so on. So how do the regions of the world rate? Well, the most diverse region is Asia. Asia has a large Christian, Muslim, unaffiliated, Hindu, Buddhist, folk religion populations. So Asia as a whole is the most diverse religious region on the planet. This is followed by sub-Saharan Africa, where you have high religious diversity. About 6 in 10 people in sub-Saharan Africa are a Christian, and the majority of the rest are Muslim, but also you have unaffiliated and folk religion. Then Europe and the Americas, North America, are about the same. Moderate religious diversity, more about 7 in 10 are Christian and then divided among other faiths. Then the least religiously diverse regions are Latin America, which is predominantly Christian, and the Middle East and North Africa, which is overwhelmingly Muslim. Okay, looking at it on a map, this is the dark color is religious diversity. So if you can find your country on the map, if it's a dark blue, you're very diverse. If it's a light blue, you're not very diverse in terms of these eight categories. These are the 10 countries with very high religious diversity, and you'll note that all of them are in Asia or Africa. So there is where you find the most religious diversity. Now, I'll finish with just a question, whether or not religious diversity is dangerous. So if you look at the countries with very high social hostilities involving religion, those include Pakistan, Afghanistan, India, and so forth. What's their religious diversity? Well, Pakistan and Afghanistan have low religious diversity. India has a moderate religious diversity. Somalia has low religious diversity. Israel has moderate religious diversity. Iraq has low religious diversity. Syria has low religious diversity. Palestinian territories have low religious diversity. Russia has moderate religious diversity, and Indonesia has low religious diversity. So the 10 countries with the highest social hostilities involving religion are predominantly low in religious diversity. They have maybe Sunni Shia diversity, but in terms of larger diversity, they're very low. So on this, by just looking at these data, there's not a strong argument to say religious diversity leads to religious hostility. In fact, it appears that the lack of diversity may be associated with hostility. Another question is, how do the 10 countries with highest diversity rank in terms of economics? Well, this was very surprising to me, that of the 10 countries with the highest religious diversity, all of them had stronger economic growth than the world average. The world average between 2008 and 2012 had 1.7% annual GDP growth. All of the countries with high diversity had more. It doesn't mean that diversity leads to economic growth, but it is interesting that all of them, without exception, had higher than average economic growth. So religious diversity may be associated with positive social outcomes. This is a publication we just released with my foundation in Indonesia with Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, looking at how this connection between economics and interfaith understanding and religious freedom. And we have a number of case studies. Brett, if I have 3 minutes, I'd like to show a video. Is that good? Okay. So I'd like to show you one of the case studies from this report. It's a study from Coca-Cola, and they were trying to address the tensions in two countries that had the highest religious hostilities on the list, India and Pakistan, that share a border and have quite a bit of conflict.
The relationship between India and Pakistan is one that has seen a lot of lows.
It's stressful, it's tense.
It seems it's not improving and it's getting worse.
It's only been 60 years that we have been apart. Before that, we were living harmoniously together.
I think all the strife would go away if you took away the barbed wires in the middle of the two countries.
It saddens me that we have this neighbor that we can't even go visit.
They have this perception, which they've been ingrained in the head, that that's the bad guy. But when they actually meet them, they realize, you know what, you're just like me.
Mainly because there's no communication. They're near us, but we have no access to them. And it's sad, because together, I think we would do wonders.
Where young people can exchange ideas, thoughts, gestures, and take away that communication gap that exists.
If I have any opportunity to go to India, I'll surely go there.
The whole idea of actually touching hands, it's like communicating with each other without words, and that action speaks louder than anything else.
This is what we are supposed to do, right? We are going to take minor steps so that we are going to solve bigger issues.
It is more about, you know, how similar we are as opposed to how different we are.
Togetherness. Humanity, this is what we want. More and more exchange.
And if I can end with one last observation I have about religious freedom, is that in 2002 we had the Olympics in Salt Lake City, and actually here in Provo, if you see this sign, this was the ice skating rink, and the Y for Brigham Young is up here. And if, you know, as you found out, this area has many people who are Mormons, and had we not had religious freedom for Mormons in the United States, this success of the Olympics after 9/11 could never have happened, because this whole community pulled together and made this Olympics happen. So having religious diversity within a country brings strengths to a country, economies, cultures that are very difficult but possible to measure. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Grimm. We'll now hear from Professor Slavica Jakalic.
Thank you. And how do I do it? Is it on?
This is to the right, and that's going back.
Okay, thank you. Is this working? Okay. Good morning. In my today's remarks, I would like to address religious secular differences and encounters as a source of positive social transformations. I want to do this as a social scientist who is interested in religion, secularism, and pluralism, but also as somebody who has experienced the power of civil society in the communist context. Somebody who saw firsthand the role that both religious and secular activists had in bringing the Yugoslav communist totalitarianism to its end in the late 1980s and the early 1990s. In many conversations about religious secular encounters today, secularism emerges as a conceptual problem. The growing body of literature on secularism shows that defining secularism is a very complicated endeavor. Secularism has developed and acquired a range of meanings, historical applications, and institutional arrangements, and these depend on specific histories and circumstances. As a result, secularism cannot be thought in a singular, only in the plural. The notion of secularism may therefore refer to a worldview, an ideology, a political doctrine, a type of moral philosophy, or a belief that a scientific method is sufficient for understanding the world in which we live. While secularism does have multiple meanings and applications, however, most scholars focus on secularism as the organizational principle of political community, the principle of separation between politics and religion, between the state and religious institutions. These discussions are important for several reasons. First, they show a wide range of models of secularism. They show that secularism is always established with regard to a specific social context and always in relation to religious histories of some society. Second, the focus on secularism as a political principle highlights the long history of conflicts and tensions between religions and secularisms. It points to the real events that happened in history in which religions and secularisms confronted each other, from various religious rejections of what was seen as the secularizing force of modernity, and this ranged from rejection of revolutions, religious freedom, even democracy, to the anti-religious policies of the Soviet communist states, ranging from direct religious persecutions to more sophisticated modes of religious oppression and control. In other words, the studies of secularism as a principle of separation between religion and politics make it impossible for us to dismiss the contemporary religious secular disputes or the boundaries of individual and collective freedoms, or to ignore the growing doubts about the secular state's ability to address the challenges of deep pluralism. Which means that in addition to being a conceptual problem, secularism is also a political problem. Most scholars today agree that secularism has become an urgent political question because of the crisis of the secular states all over the world. Crises that are shaped by the challenges of cultural pluralism and religious fundamentalism. According to some critics, however, secularism is not a political problem because of the challenges of immigration, of religious pluralization. Secularism is a political problem because of its normative assumptions, because it claims to be universal. It claims to be applicable in the same way everywhere. In my work, I trace three normative critiques of secularism. The first that addresses the Western Christian origins of secularism and its implications. The second that uncovers the nature of secularism as a foundation of modern states. And the third that unmasks the narrow secular understanding of agency. For today's conversation about varieties of secularism and religious freedom, I want to focus on the last set of critiques. These are the critiques of the secular understanding of what it means to be free and what it means to act freely in the world. These critiques are interesting because they don't simply deconstruct or reject secularism. These critiques call for a contextualized approach, a nuanced approach to what any agency, secular or religious agency, is. As I will try to show, one important result of this critique is that we are able to see religious encounters not just in terms of conflicts, but also in terms of productive and constructive engagements of their differences. Put simply, I divide my remarks in two parts. The first part is about the critique of secularism, and the second part moves beyond this critique. It's concerned with secularism as it is embedded in social context, particular social context, and embodied in concrete lives and practices. And in this second part of my talk, I want to focus particularly on solidarity. This is perhaps the least plausible place to look for a form of secularism that is kind of complex, and that's a communist society. Solidarity was the 1980 social movement in communist Poland, and I want to focus particularly on activist Adam Michnik, because I think his ideas represent secularism that was actually about disclosing, about debunking the power of a secular state, rather than to legitimize the secular state. So what I want to do is twofold. I want to point toward a multi-layered view of secularism, uncover the type of secularism that affirms not just religious freedom, but affirms the inherent value of religious tradition. Second, I want to show gesture toward social movements as context that affirm the differences between religious and secular worldviews without drawing unbridgeable distinctions between them. Every consideration of social movement, I want to say at the beginning, shows the difficult nature of any religious secular collaboration. However, the studies of social movements also indicate that religious secular differences are not reducible to conflict about power. They're not reducible to contestations about how to live in a pluralistic society. Religious secular differences can also be platforms for alliances that can transform social and political landscapes. And I would argue that that's exactly what happened with several of the 20th century social movements. Okay, so let me start quickly with a critique of secularism and secular agency. Agency is a very complicated notion. In some languages, like mine, actually it's very hard to translate it. There is no one word that can be used as a substitute for this notion. But generally, agency is understood as our ability to exert power in the world. It's commonly linked to individuals' autonomy, to freedom asserted against institutions, against customs, against traditions that are seen as something that limits our freedom. According to Talal Asad, who is one of the most influential critics of secularism, this view of agency is very particular. It's a secular view of agency. For him, this type of understanding of what it means to be free is defined by the romance of resistance. It's defined by desire to transform the world, it's a desire and the push for self-empowerment, and opposition to the external authority, opposition to the authority that is outside of us, that oppresses us. The implications of this view of agency are particularly problematic for believers. First, this view suggests that we cannot be truly free if we follow the rules and norms of some religious traditions. Second, one of the important objectives of secular agent is the elimination of suffering from the world. And the concept of suffering, or suffering as such, for most religions, is constitutive of human condition. Also, as Talal Asad points out, many religious traditions see pain as a way to create a space for moral action that articulates this world in the next world. So both Christian and Islamic traditions think that some pain must be actively endured if evil is to be transcended. So in the words of another anthropologist, Sam Mahmoud, the secular view of human freedom suggests that being free means being able to realize one's own interest against custom, tradition, and transcendental will. However, our capacity for freedom, according to the critics, is entailed not only in those acts that resist the norms, but also in the acts that inhabit, the ways in which we inhabit the norms, not how we oppose traditions, but also in how we embody them. This is important for several reasons. First, it shows that a secular understanding of what it means to be free is often taken as something natural, as a norm. However, it's very particular and it's parochial. This is a problem, according to the critics of secularism, because it impoverishes our understanding of what it means to act freely in the world. So Talal Asad proposes a contextualized, a more nuanced approach to understanding what it means to act in the world, what it means to be free, what it means to be agent. He says it's important to always ask how, by whom, and in what context the concept of agency is defined and used. And this is really important because it allows us to actually explore varieties of secularism and varieties of secular approaches to what it means to act. And this is where the Polish solidarity movement is especially illuminating. So let me turn now for a second to solidarity. It emerged in the summer of 1980. It was the first independent trade union in the Soviet bloc. Within 1 year, it grew into a social movement of 10 million Poles of all ranks, workers, engineers, intelligentsia, secular intelligentsia, and Catholic intelligentsia, and clergy. The members of Solidarity demanded better wages, so very practical goals, shorter working hours, better working conditions. But in addition to these practical goals, Solidarity members were also driven by more lofty ideals. They protested the violations of human rights and fought especially for the freedom of religion and freedom of speech. They had a peaceful methods and negotiation tactics, and they were a result of political realism. They were aware of the fact that there was always a threat of the Soviet intervention. But this was also a moral revolution. It was a civil protest and also a call for renewal of the Polish nation. This moral aspect of solidarity was very much inspired by Catholicism, by religious faith. Solidarity leaders spoke of dignity of a human being. They talked about inherent value of work. This was all language that they heard in the sermons, in the homilies of the Polish Cardinal Wyszyński, as well as in the speeches of the Polish Pope John Paul II. So solidarity was deeply embedded in Catholic symbolism and Catholic practices. Pictures of the Pope were on the walls of solidarity halls. Workers waited on their knees during lunch breaks to have their confessions heard and to receive Holy Communion. But as deeply immersed as solidarity was in Catholic tradition, it was also very much defined by a religious secular coalition. Much of the modern Polish history was defined by the lack of trust between secular and Catholic Poles, Catholic Church and secular lefts, especially after the victory of communism. But during the peak of Solidarity's activities in the 1980s, nobody thought it would be surprising that a Polish Cardinal Wyszyński could receive a delegation of pious Catholics and Jewish socialists and hand out to all of them a copy of the signed Bible. This was a confluence of the religious and the secular. It was a tacit alliance of the believers and non-believers, as one historian put it. And it did not come out of nowhere. Its sources were both religious and secular. On the Catholic side, where many members of the church hierarchy and lower clergy were suspicious of anything that had to do with secularity, there were also thinkers interested in deeper and more nuanced understanding of Marxism. And this was particularly the case with the Catholic intellectuals gathered around the Catholic magazine, Tygodnik Powszechny. In this magazine, one could read the columns of the Catholic personalist Karol Wojtyla, future Pope John Paul II, and Marxist humanist philosopher Leszek Wolakowski, columns next to each other. On the side of the secular left, there were thinkers and activists whose work enabled the dialogue with believers. And I just want to mention some of them, for example, Jacek Kuron and Karol Modzelewski, who wrote open letter to the party in which they attacked the communist regime, and they were sent to prison. The examples of the Polish secular intellectuals and activists who critiqued and opposed the regime and often ended in its prisons highlight that even in the most oppressive secular states, secularism does not have one meaning. Even more, the figures I just mentioned, Kolakowski, Kuron, Modzelewski, they all gesture towards secularism that is not just a political platform. It is also a moral stance. It's a stance used to critique secular Marxist worldview. It is secularism practiced in ways that help to disclose rather than to legitimize the powers of the secular state. Nobody, however, was more important for this dialogue between believers and non-believers than Adam Michnik. In 1977, he published the book The Church and the Left, which resulted from his conclusion that the concepts and strategies used to explore relations between the left and the church in Poland had to be revisited. Michnik's call for dialogue was a result of his pragmatic considerations. But the most striking feature of Michnik's invitation to dialogue was not his strategy. It was the critique of the left, and it was the praise of the Polish Catholic Church and Christianity. Michnik condemned the anti-clericalism of the left. In Michnik's views, such anti-clericalism was ahistorical. We fear and reject, he wrote, the conservative, nationalistic, all-powerful institution that the Polish Catholic Church once was. This is now a different church. the church stubbornly on the side of the persecuted and the oppressed. This is a church that was the only public institution in communist Poland, according to Michnik, to speak bravely on behalf of freedom and the rights of every human being. So he concluded, not only do we, the Polish secular left, need to enter a dialogue with the Catholic Church, not only that we need to reject the primitive atheism of communist states, our search must go deeper, he said. It must touch the very roots of that conviction that it is we, that is secular left, who know the path the true path of progress and reason. The truth is we do not know this path. Neither we nor anybody else in this world knows the road along which history will travel. So let us respect those who believe that the supernatural world has been revealed to them. Let us judge them by their deeds and not by the words that are twisted and distorted by others. So Michnik demands two things from the secular left and from himself: self-critique and respect towards religious others. He affirms the respect of the secular Poles towards religious believers because of the ability of the Polish Catholicism for historical transformation. But he does it also because he identifies inherent dignity in religious traditions. Michnik's approach to religion within the context of Polish national history contains a call for a different interfacing between the religious and the secular. His ideas about religion first, the ideas of a secular leftist activist in the context of a communist society, they show a chastened secular disposition. His secularism is a secularism aware of the limits of human powers. Even more, it's a secularism willing to learn about those limits from Christianity. Second, Michnik's discourse of rights moves in an interesting direction. The point is, he writes, that our affection for civil liberties would be rather suspect were we to desire them only for ourselves. He believes that it is the role of him as a representative of the secular left to fight for the freedom of the Catholic Church, for the freedom of religion. Put differently, he doesn't use the language of rights to affirm his own rights, but to affirm the rights of the other. This is also the foundation of his call for dialogue between religious and the secular Poles. For him, true dialogue is a capacity to see the validity of somebody else's view. It's the only way to construct a good and desirable democratic order. So let me propose a couple of questions as a way of conclusion. The analysis of solidarity was shaped by the questions about the meanings of secularism in a very specific historical setting, that of a communist regime. Rather than focusing on the ideology, on policies and institutions of a secular state, rather than exploring secularism as a principle of church-state separation, I was concerned with the ideas and practices of secular actors in the context of a communist society. And this inquiry resulted in several questions. If the secular view of human freedom is defined by the push for self-empowerment, which is what the critics of secularism suggest, how are we to understand Michnik's call for the self-examination of the secular left? How can we make sense of this call for rejection of the secular ideas about and their practices towards Catholicism? Can the critiques of the secular approach to agency and freedom help explain how and why Michnik and other secular activists use the language of rights, not only in order to empower themselves, but also in order to empower the others, religious believers? How should the instances of Michnik's or Kurenier's imprisoned be interpreted? Are they a result of the secular romance of resistance, or are they more similar to the suffering affirmed by religious traditions? Most importantly, how should we classify solidarity secularism? Is it reducible to ideology? Is it reducible to anti-religiousness? If those who articulated and enacted it recognize the dignity and moral force of religion, and they created an alliance with Catholic intellectuals and workers? Or could solidarity secularism be seen as a moral orientation toward and in this world, which is driven by desire to affirm human flourishing of all, believers and non-believers alike? These questions, it seems to me, call attention to the need to explore the meanings and practices of secularism outside the focus on the role of secular states in relation to religious establishments. These questions also highlight the problem of the approach to secular perspectives on freedom as necessarily opposed to and radically different from religious approaches to freedom. Of course, we should not deny the differences, irreducible differences between religious and secular worldviews. This is something that the Polish religious and secular activists recognize very well. At the same time, it is important also to identify the productive sides of encounter between religious and secular actors. It's important to appreciate the internal heterogeneity of the religious and the secular as categories. For example, drawing a sharp distinction between secular resistance to external norms and religious affirmation of suffering, this distinction becomes very difficult when we see that the actions of both religious and secular leaders in solidarity were not just about empowerment, they were also about sacrifice. And both religious and non-religious forms of sacrifice, despite all their differences, are ultimately about self-transcendence. On my reading, the ideas and practices of secularism in the context of solidarity should not be seen as just an isolated case that contradicts some dominant mode of secularism in the modern world. On the one hand, the Polish case directs our attention to the multi-layered meanings of secularism, which can emerge even in the most secular of contexts, such as communist societies. On the other hand, there is another, even more important reason why the case of solidarity and the type of secularism it affirmed should not be seen as an exception. The case of solidarity points to the potential that social movements have for the exploration of the religious secular encounters as a source of positive social transformations. What do I mean by this? If we compare the Polish case with several other cases, for example, labor movements and civil rights movement in the United States, or the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, what emerges is the picture of movements constituted by plurality of secular and religious voices. In all the mentioned cases, religious and secular activists and leaders recognize their differences, but also identify their shared ideals of racial, economic, and social justice. As a result, they're able to form alliances that transform the political and social landscapes of the 20th century. Theorist James Jasper writes that the importance of protest in the context of social movements doesn't lie in their practical accomplishment. The importance of these processes is in the fact that they provide us with, quote, a rare chance to probe our moral intuitions and articulate these intuitions as political principles. Social movements, in other words, present themselves as a productive, particularly productive site of religious secular encounters. It's an opportunity to retrieve the sort of concrete experiences, normative commitments, and ethos of political action, which is needed to address the blossoming plurality of religious and secular worlds, outlooks in contemporary world. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Jakalich. Next, we will hear from Dean Akinola Ibidapo Obe.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. My topic of discussion is on incubating terrorism, the prior subversion of Nigeria's secular constitution and freedom of religion. Ladies and gentlemen, Nigeria has a population of 180 million. For every African that you see, there is a Nigerian. That means that we are one quarter of the black population of the world. Now, if you look at the map of Africa and you turn it slightly to the right, some people have said that Nigeria is actually the trigger of Africa. If anything goes wrong in Nigeria, the whole of Africa goes wrong. So it's in this context that I want us to view the simmering and very explosive situation that is going on in Nigeria, even as we speak. 2 weeks ago, the Senate of the Federal Republic of Nigeria were gathered in the same way that we are gathered here. They had just returned from their holidays in all the world capitals. It reminds you of the popular phrase that while Rome burns, Emperor Nero is fiddling. While Nigeria is on the brink of collapse, our Senate of 100 people and our legislature of about 400 went on holiday and returned. And by the time they returned, these past two weeks, the Boko Haram, which translates as simply as Western education is a sin, they had seized six villages, towns, in three states in the northern eastern part of Nigeria. So, and the AFP circulated a video of the Boko Haram hoisting their black flag in Gwoza and declaring in the manner of the Islamic State a caliphate in Gwoza. So the Senate was in a panic. And they resolved at that meeting 2 weeks ago to see the president, Jonathan, and ask him what he was doing about the terrorist attacks, which seemed to be gaining ground. Almost simultaneously in the House of Representatives of Nigeria, also in Abuja, our 400-member team were also talking about the same problem. They had seen the AFP video showing the Islamists on their Hilux vehicles and their RPGs and their tanks and firing into the villages. And as a matter of fact, there was a slide shown which showed 20 people who had been captured by the Islamists and who, in the actual video, were being bludgeoned to death with shovels because they were Christians and they had refused to convert to Islam. On the other hand, those who were threatened, convert or die, converted. And as soon as they were converted, 14-year-old boys, 13-year-old boys, they were conscripted into the Boko Haram army. Nigeria is in a state of terrible dilemma. The question that I try to answer here is, how did the Boko Haram menace get to the point where we seem totally to have lost control, where Boko Haram on a daily basis is gaining inroads? Not only have they captured 300 girls that they have not released as we speak, this is the 175th day of the capture of the girls. 7 days ago, they released one of the girls, and I think they wanted to send a message to the Nigerian public. They took her in a vehicle, threw her out of in a city in the north, and when the girl was retrieved and taken to hospital, she had been severely, sexually assaulted, and she was pregnant. I put it to us, and that was the message they were sending to us, that virtually all those 300 girls will have suffered a similar fate. Why is Boko Haram gaining its strength? why has Boko Haram become the nemesis of the Nigerian state? This is the question that I attempt to answer. So in my first segment, after the introduction, I try to trace what I consider to be the subversion of the Nigerian nationhood right from the moment of colonialism. And in my second segment, I tried to situate the Nigerian problem, as it were, in a global context. And I tried to let us see that what is playing out in Nigeria is part of the struggle for world power using religion as the platform. And therefore, I talk about religion, terrorism, and world power. And then I go on in my third segment, and I locate the problem of religion in the Nigerian situation, and I talk about state patronage of religion, the manner in which religion has been patronized by the Nigerian state to turn it into the monster that it has become. And then, of course, everybody is aware that in the year 2000, 12 states out of Nigeria's 36 states adopted the Sharia legal system. And Nigeria has never been the same since that point. So I look at how Sharia law, juxtaposes with the constitution of Nigeria with human rights predicates. And then I try to look at what has given rise to the Boko Haram phenomenon. And I locate the problem in the elite of the North who deliberately, over the years, have been trying to groom what I'll call this army of disgruntled youth as a lever of power, as a way of getting back into political relevance. There is no doubt in my mind that the Boko Haram, I've been in Nigeria, I've lived in Nigeria all my life, and I've experienced all these things. There is no doubt in my mind that the Northern elite haven't been dispossessed of power. They had thought power was their own property. Having been dispossessed of power, have now seen the Boko Haram as a way of intimidating a Christian president into relinquishing power and surrendering his dreams of a second term in office. So this is the approach that I have taken. And I quickly go on to the issue of how the colonial government have effectively sown the seeds of the domination of the politics of Nigeria by the Islamic wing of Nigeria. By the way, I was intrigued when the last speaker was talking about the statistics of religion and so on and so forth. Not the last speaker, the one before. I don't think anybody has bothered in Nigeria, and that's an irony, of checking how many Christians there are, how many Muslims there are, how many people still subscribe to the traditional religion. I suggest to us that why we have not been able to do so is that we realize that when ultimately these statistics is taken, it will reveal that Nigeria is a situation in which the minority has in fact been controlling the majority. The minority Islamic elite who are Muslims have been manipulating censors and information to appear as if they are in the majority. Whereas I know that given the concentration of the population in the southern vegetation, there are in fact more Christians than there are Muslims. Now, when the colonial power amalgamated Nigeria in 1914, some people said that Nigeria became a geographical expression and not a nation, because what we had happening at that point was a forced union of 250 ethnic groups into one nation. As it is now, that has appeared to be a misadventure of sorts, because these ethnicities have not been able to forge themselves into a single nation, and that is the dilemma of Nigeria. When the British were withdrawing in 1960, they gave power to the northern Islamic power block. They gave 70% of the land mass of Nigeria to the Islamists, leaving 30% for what they consider to be the half of the population of Nigeria. It's not possible by any permutation for any Southern Christian to emerge as the president of Nigeria, given the fact that according to the census of the British, according to their own calculations, 70% or 60% of Nigerians come from the north. So it has always been a case of the northern power bloc aligning with either the east or the west to control power, to dominate. And I think that this is the problem that Britain, as a departing colonial power, put Nigeria into. And that has been the beginning of our dilemma. I go on in my second segment to explain that there was a conspiracy of sorts. While the northern Islamists were being, while the missionaries, Christian missionaries, were being excluded from making inroads into the north to keep the northern population uneducated, they allowed the missionaries to come in. And therefore, we had the Christian schools and all the rest of it, and many of us were able to get educated. Right now, as it stands, 10 million Nigerian children who ought to be in school, 10 million, are not in school. 8 million of them are from the north. So we have 8 million youth roaming about the streets of the north without any education, without any prospects of employment, and I think that they are a veritable source of recruitment for the Islamic power, the Islamic jihad. And then these are people that went to the madrasas. They are called al-Majiri. At 4 years, they are handed over to the Islamic scholar in their droves, and they do not go to school. They are given Islamic education, no formal education at all. And by the time they are 14, 15, and they are able to perpetrate all kinds of criminalities, they are let loose on the population. A lot of churches were built, a lot of Christians were converted during the Pentecostal drive of the 1980s. We had a lot of Pentecostal missionaries coming to Nigeria to convert people. I think at that point, there was a pervasive fear that Christian religion was making inroads into the north that they hitherto did not have. And therefore, they were scared. And what happened was to now unleash the al-Majiri on the Christian churches that were being built, on the Christian populations that were increasing, and those who had been converted, and there was mayhem. At the end of my paper, I gave a chronological account of all the so-called religious riots that had happened, almost 40, from the 1970s to these times. I want to suggest that it is this untamed religious riot that has metamorphosized into the Boko Haram. If people attack churches and there are no people arrested and there are no people prosecuted, then it will strengthen these jobless youth to think that in fact they are invincible and that they are untouchable. And the Boko Haram revolution, as it were, is just one step beyond the so-called Islamic riots, which have been going on. So I've talked about the conceptual subversion of the Nigerian state. Now, what has happened is that when it is convenient, the Islamic power bloc and the Christians tend to get together to suppress the traditional religionists. I'm very much aware that even those who are converted to Christianity and who propose to be Muslims, some of them are still engaged in these cultural practices, in this cultural religion. In other words, they have been forced to profess Christianity and Islam because they know that they are at a disadvantage. there is no religious freedom. So all of them say, oh, I'm a Christian, I'm a Muslim, and then they suppress their traditional religion. There was a conspiracy between a powerful Islamic bloc and a less powerful but also subsisting Christian bloc to suppress the traditional religion. And having suppressed the traditional religion, and there was no other group to suppress, then they faced each other. Now we are having the Islamists versus the Christians. So there was a gradual move to suppress the traditional African religion. And then we know that from time to time, when you go to, we have 36 governors in that small state called Nigeria. The states are not viable. They all go cap in hand to beg for subvention from the government. So what happens is that when they have their state houses, if you are a Muslim governor, then you build a mosque in the government house. And that tells everybody, look, I'm with you. There's a mosque in the government house. And then, of course, that continued for a long while until we had a Christian president in Obasanjo. And when he got there, thinking, being a former military person, he too now built a church in Abuja. We call it Aso Rock, the seat of power. And for many Islamists, he has never been forgotten for having the temerity to build a Christian worship house in the center of power, which they believe is a Muslim inheritance. So it's not been difficult. It's been very difficult to separate religion from Islam all this while. It's been very difficult. And what you then find is that in the school system, a lot of schools are being closed because they are not teaching the Islamic religion. A lot of schools are being closed because they don't allow Islamic teachers to come and put. So if it's a Christian church and you are running that school, a missionary school, and you have your students and so on and so forth, they will now say you should employ a Muslim teacher to teach Islam. And if you refuse, that school will be closed. So I'm saying that the genesis of the Boko Haram phenomenon has been the Al-Majiri system, has been the, if you like, the disempowerment of the girls. Now, I'm sure you all remember the case of Amina Lawal. This was a girl who was charged with adultery because she was pregnant, and therefore they sentenced her to death for adultery. The man that put her in the family will was not sentenced to death, and there was a whole hue and cry all over the world. Now, there was a lady who also is a product of that section of the country called Hawa Ibrahim. She's a lawyer. She was the one that championed Amina's case and was able to get a reprieve for Amina. When she was telling her story, and this is very significant, she said, my parents wanted to marry me off at the age of 10. 10. But I refused. I ran away and went to take refuge in a seminary. And that was how I was able to get education. Ladies and gentlemen, a lot of northern young girls of between 10 and 14 and 15 are being married off to 50-year-olds, 60-year-olds, whatever. And they're not able to go to school. There is the popular aphorism that if you teach a woman, you teach a nation. That is where we got the idea of the mother tongue. So now that you have a dispossessed, disempowered woman folk, what do you have? You don't have educated children anymore. So, and this is very significant. Our Senate was called upon to abolish the child marriage law. They voted by a majority of 83. We have 100 to keep the marriage law that allows 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds to be married off. In fact, one or two or three senators that I know, there was one senator that got married to a 13-year-old Egyptian, paid about $200,000 to her father, and brought her to Nigeria. And the senator was about 56 years old. So when you have a disempowered women folk, disempowered young boys, then you have terrorism. Now, I come to the solution, because I'm rounding up. What is the solution? What is the solution to Boko Haram? And we need to prove a solution. The solution to Boko Haram is that Nigeria should be allowed to have a 6 regional structure, to have regional autonomy, to allow all the different ethnicities to be able to express themselves within a particular autonomous regime, and not have one religion dominate the other and impose its own will on the people. I am not able to go into the corruption and how the northern elite disempower their own people. But one of the things that we hear from the American government is that, oh, you should now start educating the Boko Haram. That should have happened 20 years ago, not now. Because it is those Almajiri that were, at the age of 4, handed over to the madrasas that are now the Boko Haram insurgents. So to now propose that we educate Almajiri as of today is medicine after death. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Ibidapo Obe. We will next hear from Professor Daniel Philpott.
Thank you, Professor, and greetings, everyone. The title of my presentation today, Religious Freedom in Islam, is the title of a book that I am now writing on this subject. To what extent is there religious freedom in Islam, and what are the prospects for increasing religious freedom in Islam? Perhaps then, more than for most topics, to pose the very question of the title is to raise eyebrows and blood pressure. To some, it might seem like too large of a question. How can we ask such a general question of a religion of 14 centuries and 1.6 billion people? To others, it evokes the culture war over Islam that seems to resurface in the Western media every time Islam has come into the news, from September 11th, 2001, to the recent rise of the Islamic State. It is a culture war in which one side says that Islam is inherently violent and intolerant, and the other side says that it is peaceful, diverse, and often the victim of Western domination. Some will question the standpoint from which the question is framed. Religious freedom, they will say, is a Western value, derived from Western experience and history. It can even be a tool of Western power and domination. It should not be readily be imposed on Islam, either in policy or through analysis. It is my view, however, that the question of religious freedom in Islam is one that can be applied to Islam as a whole through identifying broad patterns, eludes the polarization of the culture wars, and in fact evokes a universal criterion rooted in human dignity and interest rather than a merely Western perspective. In my view, and the premise of my talk, is that religious freedom rightfully belongs in the most important human rights documents as a principle that is properly evoked with respect to any religion or state. It is also my view that religious freedom would be beneficial to Islam, allowing it to flourish as a religion and encouraging stability, peace, and democracy. Indeed, the way that it would be beneficial invokes the theme of the conference, varieties of secularism. Among the many forms of secularism that exist, and the term can mean many things, I wish to highlight two for analysis, negative and positive secularism. Negative secularism is the form that represses religion out of hostility and in the desire to advance an anti-religious program. Positive secularism is an institutional separation of religion and state that allows religion to practice and to participate in politics, as long as it allows other religions full and equal participation. It is a positive secularism that I believe is beneficial to Islam, and indeed to any religion or state. It is a secularism that is friendly to religion. My purpose today, though, is a narrower one, reflecting the time that I have remaining.
Thank you. Hopefully you can hear me better. My purpose today, though, is a narrower one, reflecting the time that I have remaining. It is to get at the question of religious freedom in Islam by laying out a typology of regimes and then aiming to draw a few conclusions from it. From a satellite view, looking at it as a large overview, it would seem that religious freedom suffers a troubled fate in Islam. When Islam is viewed in the aggregate, it appears that there is a dearth of religious freedom. Let's take a look at the world's 47 or so countries where Muslims are a majority and compare them to the rest of the world. Here I draw upon data from the Pew Forum's rankings on religious freedom, to which we are all greatly indebted, and to which my colleague sitting right here, Brian Grimm, played such a pivotal role in developing. I also use Brian's book with Roger Finke, The Price of Religious Freedom Denied. These data show that when compared to the entire world, as well as to majority Christian states, Islam has considerably lower levels of religious freedom. The comparison with the Christian world, and by that I mean states in which Christians are a majority, is worth making because Christianity is the world religion that is in the same league as Islam in terms of population and in being spread out among numerous states. One can think of Hinduism, for instance, as a very large religion, but it is concentrated mostly in one or perhaps two states. My own analysis, using the religion and state data set of political scientist Jonathan Fox, results in a similar conclusion. In his index, religious freedom is approximated by the variable official restrictions, which ranges from 0 as the least restrictive to 5 as the most restrictive. A comparison of country scores for the period 1990 to 2008 shows an average of 2.6 for the Muslim majority countries, compared with a global average of 1.77 and an average of 1.36 for Christian countries. Do I conclude then that Islam is generally inhospitable to religious freedom? No, that is too simple. If we zoom in from a satellite view to a more fine-grained view, we see much greater diversity than the aggregate statistics tell us. First, we learn that 12 out of 47 or so Muslim-majority states, nearly one quarter, fall into the category of low restrictions on religious freedom in the Pew ratings, meaning that they are essentially religiously free. But even among the other 35 Muslim majority states, which have moderate, high, or very high levels of restriction, we find significantly different patterns of repression. There are two patterns in particular, namely Islamist states, which represent 21 or 60% of these countries, and secular repressive states, which represent 14 or 40% of these countries. Let us take a closer look at what we can learn from them. And I should be clear here that I am assessing these countries as they stood in 2009, prior to the Arab Spring and dramatic changes in other countries like Turkey. The Islamist pattern represents those Muslim-majority states that deny religious freedom through using the state's laws, policies, and coercive power to promote and enforce a highly restrictive and traditional form of Sharia or Islamic law. We heard something about that from the professor in the 12 out of 36 Nigerian states. The slide shows the list of 21 Islamic states. Now, some of this needs to be nuanced. There probably should be some dates put on there. In Nigeria, again, I'm really referring to the 12 out of the 36 states, not the entire country, and so forth. But that gives you the broad landscape. Typical instruments of Islamist repression are clauses in the Constitution that declare Islam the official religion of the state, or that no law shall contradict Islam, codes that strictly enforce against blasphemy and apostasy, laws that declare an entire sect of Islam to be apostate, policies that make it difficult for dissenting sects of religious or religious minorities to construct buildings, express themselves through the media, and practice their faith in a host of other ways, and strong governance of universities, schools, seminaries, houses of worship, modes of dress, marriage, and observances of the faith. Often restrictions on religious freedom imposed through law and policy also give a green light to militant groups to act as vigilantes and enforce Islamism on their own. To use the categories of Grimm and Finke, government restrictions often encourage social hostilities. Iran and Saudi Arabia are the standard bearers of Islamism, both because they are exemplars and because they have sought actively to spread Islam around the world. A category of Islamist state worth looking at more closely is Islamist democracies, including Malaysia, Bangladesh, Indonesia, and Pakistan. All of these countries have hosted significant numbers of contested elections in recent years, though not without punctuation. Indonesia, the largest Islamic state in the world, is a kind of model Islamic democracy if looked at in terms of electoral democracy. Interestingly, as several scholars have shown, Islamist parties do not fare well in democratic elections. When the question is put to the voters, generally they overwhelmingly reject the agenda or putting into power Islamist parties. However, Islamist democracies do not display high levels of religious freedom. Many scholars have rightly pointed to and mapped out significant levels of democracy in the Muslim world. But democracy does not spell religious freedom. Even if a country has popular rule in elections, it can still make life difficult for religious minorities and dissenting Islamic sects, as do Pakistan and Indonesia, for instance, towards the Ahmadi sect. In fact, electoral competition in these countries actually helps to promote religious repression oftentimes. In response to a global Islamic popular resurgence of the 1970s, the dominant political parties, who are not themselves Islamist in many of these countries, adopted Islamist agendas in order to sideline and co-opt the more radical parties and capture their share of votes. Even if the small Islamist parties did not capture power then, they managed to promote their agenda through electoral politics. Adding more complexity to the relationship between Islam and religious freedom are the 40% of repressive Muslim-majority countries that fall into the secular repressive pattern. If the Iranian Revolution is the inspiration for Islamist states, the French Revolution is the model for this pattern. It is telling that religious freedom is denied by the French Revolution nearly as often as it is by the Iranian Revolution. In these states, the power of government is also used to manage religion, but here it is on behalf of an agenda of modernity involving social equality, nationalism, and economic development along Western lines. Such regimes seek not to promote traditional Islam, but rather to contain it, and if possible, privatize it. They correspond to what I have called negative secularism. At times, these states may adopt portions of the Islamist agenda, as had Egypt. But this is a concession to the population, expected to be temporary as modernity steams ahead. Egypt, at least prior to the Arab Spring, also had placed thousands of members of the Muslim Brotherhood in jail, something that no Islamist regime would ever do. Secular repressive regimes deny religious freedom by heavily restricting the activities of Muslims and often minority religions too. In some cases, as we know from Hafez Assad's Syria and Mubarak's Egypt, secular repressive regimes can also protect minorities, as these regimes did for Christians. But this protection can be precarious. The standard bearer of restrictive secular regimes is the Republic of Turkey, founded by Kemal Atatürk in 1924. After World War II, many Arab states followed this model, forming regimes on the basis of secularism, nationalism, and economic development. Finally, to complexify things further, there are also religiously free regimes in the Muslim world, which adds further complexity to the negative judgment of the satellite view. Here is a list of religiously free Islamic states. Most of them are outside the Arab world. And one of the objects of my analysis is to determine what factors have led to their free condition. And these correspond to what I have called positive secularism. Overall, what conclusions can we draw from this analysis? There are several. First, in the aggregate, Islam ranks low on religious freedom. Second, if there is a dearth of religious freedom in Islam, this does not mean that Islam is necessarily the cause of low religious freedom. Secular repressive governments are a main cause of repression in the Muslim world as well. Third, there are in fact religiously free countries in Islam, and they point to the possibility of there being more religiously free countries in Islam. Fourth, while there are impressive examples of electoral democracies in Islam, democracy does not necessarily spell religious freedom and can even encourage repression. Fifth, and finally, the categories in the present analysis can help us to understand contemporary changes like the Arab Spring. Now, I said that my analysis and my typology was based on 2009. And so, obviously, some very important things have happened in the Muslim world since that time. And this is all working out. Like I said, my work is a work in progress. But one of the things I seek to do is to use these categories to try to help understand the changes in the Islamic world today. Egypt, for instance, went from being a secular repressive country, I argue, under Mubarak, to being challenged by protesters who advocated for a religiously free country, to then being governed by an Islamist model, and now under Morsi, and now it's back to a secular repressive model under al-Sisi. And so the kind of changes that have taken place, I think, can be captured by these categories. Increasingly difficult to categorize is Turkey. Until 2002, it was the standard bearer of the secular repressive pattern. After the AKP was elected, it started to make strides towards being religiously free, though still in the pattern of secular repressive. However, since 2011 or 2012, there are also signs of Islamism coming to the fore. So I think it's a complex combination. Well, these are only a few of the conclusions that I have derived from my analysis thus far, and I look forward to the discussion. Thank you.
Well, I think we've already seen how broad and varied the perspectives are. We appreciate Professor Grimm and his world overview setting the stage for a deeper understanding of religious demographics, and also the provocative questions he raised about the significance and meaning of religious diversity and religious pluralism. Professor Yakalich helped focus our minds on the importance of our definitions and how we define secularism. And the really interesting example of Poland illustrates the complex interactions of religion and secular voices in an enterprise of reform. Dean Ibidapo Obe gave us a sobering reflection on the state of affairs in Nigeria, where religion is often used as a mechanism for division, and also raised really interesting questions about the uses and misuses of education by religious majorities. Professor Philpott tackles a very ambitious project of thinking systematically about freedom of religion within the Islamic tradition. It is, of course, important to remember that 150 years ago, the Pope of the Catholic Church described religious freedom as a type of mental illness. And so we find that within religious traditions themselves are usually found the most powerful arguments for transforming and reimagining and mining and finding the best within each of our traditions. Each of our traditions, I suspect, has resources both for coercive attitudes towards religion and also human dignity-based arguments seeking greater freedom. It's also, again, having our minds focused on the importance of definitions, the distinction between negative secularism and positive secularism really invites us to engage with the theme of this symposium of the varieties of secularism. And noting the variety within Islam, I think, is very important. For Westerners, it is too easy for us to imagine Islam as a monolithic force, and even the distinction between the secular control regimes and the Islamicist regimes is one that can advance our ways of thinking. Our speakers have been generous in both sharing with us very provocative, thoughtful, and well-prepared insights, but also in leaving time. We now have about 20 minutes, and we have two students with microphones in the back of the room. If you would raise your hands, I will recognize questions. We'll ask you to keep your questions brief, and please indicate to whom the question is directed. I open it now to the floor. Arum, yes, thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Scharf.
Could you begin by stating your name and where you're from?
Mm-hmm. My name is Arum, and I am not a religious person. I'm a lawyer. I'm a lecturer in the Faculty of Law back in Indonesia. And I have a question for Professor Brian Dream. And you have an amazing presentation. I enjoyed it very much. And I would agree with you that conflict merely occur in the country that have less diversity, but with well, such as in my country, in Indonesia, we have a very strong majority Muslim. But I would say that the conflict is not between, well, there are some conflict between Muslim and Christian, for example, but inside Muslim themselves, we have different interpretations of religion, and there occur some conflicts in the society. I would argue that such conflict occur because of the perceptions of being majority. We tend to, well, it's not a good word, discriminate the minority because we have the power. And what I saw is in the Islamic, I would say, Muslim countries, and my field research in those countries. But I would like to know, in your research, is it the same case happen in the Christian majority country when they feel to be a majority, and how their attitude towards minority? If the case will be the same, they tend to discriminate or
okay,
minority,
so
then we have the generic problem. If it is not the case, so we need to dig it up deeper. What is the real root of such conflict? Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for the question. A very, very important question. And I can give an example from one country that I visit a lot, is Brazil. So Professor Scharfs mentioned that the Catholic Church's teaching on religious freedom has changed. And it made a major change during Vatican II, where it embraced religious freedom as resident within each person. So each person must make their own choice, and it's not the duty of the state to enforce a particular religious point of view. After that change, Brazil was going through a major religious shift from being all Catholic to today being very much more diverse within Christianity, especially with Pentecostal, Protestant, Evangelical, Mormon, Seventh-day Adventist. And this change happened with no violence. So the thing that I find amazing, that's amazing, to have this major change with no violence. The majority respected religious freedom. The Catholic Church was not happy people left. But then they ask, why are they leaving? It's a good question. So I think that the secret there is not the difference between Islam and Christianity, but the choice theologically to recognize religious freedom within the religion. So I would suggest that within Islam, if there would be a Vatican II, there's no Vatican, but if there would be something like a theological understanding that religious freedom is important within Islam, I think then this would make a big change.
I think your question, Professor Autumn, is very important. In looking at the data that Professor Grimm has put together, one thing I've noticed is there are often very high correlations between dominant religions and a low degree of religious freedom, not just in Islamic countries. For example, with a Hindu majority in India, we have quite high social hostilities. With Buddhist majority in Myanmar, we have very high religious hostilities. With Christian Orthodox majorities in Greece or in Russia, other Orthodox countries, we have quite high levels of both legal and social hostilities. But there is a big exception, and that is Catholic majority countries. If you look at the Catholic majority countries around the world and correlate them with the data about social hostilities and legal restrictions, they're very low. And I attribute that to what Professor Grimm has just identified, which is Catholic doctrine as it emerged from Vatican II. And so I think it is going to be largely within religious traditions that the resources that favor religious freedom and respect and pluralism are likely to be found. And it's really, in large measure, Professor Grimm's data which has enabled us to really focus and identify those patterns. Other questions? Yes, thank you. Here comes the microphone from the other side. Your name and your affiliation first, please, as we get to know each other.
Yeah, Femi Falana is my name. I'm from Nigeria. I'm a legal practitioner. I think this question is for Professor Fipot on Islam and terrorism in the world today. Now, don't you see some hypocrisy on the part of Western governments that support and maintain very close relationships with countries in the Middle East, like Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and others that have nothing to do with democracy. And the attitude to countries like Egypt under Morsi, you know, where people also vote for a particular political party that is also Islamic, that is also practicing Sharia law, like Saudi Arabia and others. Why, I mean, how do we justify the instigation of regime change in some of these countries, like Egypt, even the Taliban? If people have voted for a particular government, don't we have the right to respect their rights, their wishes? Why should countries that profess democracy instigate overthrow of such regimes? Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure. Well, that was a very good question. I actually see two questions. One was about the hypocrisy of countries like the United States in supporting, you know, repressive governments and so forth. And then the one was about, shouldn't we always respect the outcome of electoral decisions? In terms of the hypocrisy, yes, I agree. I mean, I think that, you know, much as, you know, in the Cold War, the United States was often, too willing to support repressive governments, and despite our democratic values, I think today we're often too willing to support repressive governments, you know, in the fight against terrorism. Obviously, that's a complex issue, but I think that religious freedom itself and a more consistent support for religious freedom could be a kind of long-term enlightened interest. I think that if we better understood the prospects of religious freedom for bringing stability and democracy and some of the things that Brian Grimm has shown that religious freedom is correlated with, I think we would have better relations in the long run. I mean, a classic example is the United States, longstanding support for the Shah of Iran, very repressive secular kind of model, and brought us this Islamist revolution in the end because we didn't understand the importance of religion, and so I tend to agree. Now on the question of shouldn't we strongly respect the outcome of democratic elections? I mean, yes, it does seem our values as Americans seem to point that way. I would only say, though, that, I mean, there's different ways of defining democracy. This is something I was trying to get at in my presentation. One way is to look at it in terms of elections, electoral democracy. But the problem, though, is that you can have that kind of democracy, but still have highly repressive policies, say, towards religious minorities or dissenters. And so I would expand it into liberal democracy, which not only has elections, but also has a robust respect for minorities and human rights and so forth. And that's where, I think in countries like Pakistan and so forth, where you do have elections, but you don't have a strong religious freedom. So I think we need to insist on more than just elections, but also insist upon, the religious freedom that's embedded in the human rights covenants.
Other questions? I think we have time for one or two more. Thank you.
Thanks very much. I was speaking French. Je suis Joseph Yav Kachung.
Joseph, could you pause just long enough for us to get our headphones on?
Or if you want, I can ask my question in English.
No, French is great. We just, since you're the first speaker this session, not in English, some of us don't need to get our headphones set.
Okay.
All right, please, go ahead.
Yes, Joseph Yav Kachung, je suis professeur en République démocratique du Congo et avocat. J'ai bien suivi toutes les présentations et surtout les réponses qui ont été données en rapport avec la question de mon ami Femi. Il a posé la question à M. Daniel Philpott.
Where is English?
Mais j'aimerais poser une question aux quatre. Is that okay? Okay, I would like to ask a question to all four. Yes, it's from based on the freedom of religion. How can we assess freedom of religion in a country like the Democratic Republic of Congo, where we are free to attend religion ceremonies, to open or create churches, and so on? We have a lot every day. Everyone is a bishop, is a pastor, is so and so on. Can we say that by creating, by establishing churches, by going to church, that is freedom of religion, whereby we find discrimination provided by the law, despite the fact that the state is a secular, DRC is a secular state, but we still refer in some provision to God. The president should say so and so, God, and even in several meetings where the president or ministers thanks God for this or pray. I think in such situation, are we sure that the freedom of religion is secured? Thanks.
So let me give each of our panelists a chance to respond. Maybe we'll just move in the opposite order of how we spoke originally this morning. The question, as I understand it, is how do you view the core definition of freedom of religion, and how does that relate to preferentialism when some religions seem to have a heightened legal or social status within a particular country? Professor Philpott?
Well, it's a very good question. I mean, I think it's possible in principle to have religious freedom, meaning the freedom of groups and individuals to practice their religion, and at the same time have some kind of affirmation of religion on the part of the state. You talked about the Congo state, talking about referring to God. I think of Indonesia, which has Pancasila, the belief in one God. Other states have similar provisions. Some states have a state kind of provision of a national church, like England has a national church. Poland has a national church. But I think it's possible to have that on one hand, but also respect the freedom to practice for anyone of any religion. I mean, I think England broadly has that, and I think it's, you can say that this state, this nation, is embodied in a certain religion, or that it's important to have a belief in God, but also have freedom for those who think otherwise or practice otherwise. However, I don't want to be naive about that. There are also tensions, and there are also ways in which that kind of state affirmation can be discriminatory. And so it's a balance that always needs to be maintained. If you have like Indonesia and China, which identify five or six religions as the official ones, what happens to those who don't belong to those, and so forth? So it's possible in principle, but in practice, it's something that needs to be, managed very carefully.
Thank you. Dean Ibidapo Obey.
Yes, I think for most African countries, the dice is loaded. When we talk about religious freedom, we're actually talking about the freedom to practice the religion of the erstwhile colonial powers. If you look at the Nigerian situation, there are a lot of laws that discriminate against African culture. They deliberately promoted Islamism in the north to ensure that there was a division. So I don't call that freedom of religion, because there seems to be freedom to open churches and all the rest of it. I think that from the beginning, the dice has been loaded. Freedom of religion will mean freedom to even practice your traditional religion or no religion at all. But I don't think that is their own definition. So it is value loaded. colonialism, impaired in terms of that freedom. Thank you.
Professor Yakalich.
Well, I have to admit that I find my role today to be one of the people who complexifies the definitions. And so I want to say that I'm very skeptical of talking about freedom of religion without knowing what religion means first. And so is religion something that refers to our beliefs? Is religion something that refers to the freedom to practice rituals? Is religion something that refers to institutions and their freedom to be publicly present? Is religion something related to collective identities and national identities, which it is in some cases? So my response to that would be that instead of sort of looking just from above, we always need to start from below and look at social contexts, specific historical moments, and understand what's really going on the ground to be able to even talk about what religion means in any society.
Professor Grimm.
Yeah, very, very good question. So, in the work that I've done, I've tried to measure the ways that governments restrict religion. They can restrict literature, proselytism, broadcasting, conversion, use force against religion. And a restriction I consider is when they favor one religion above others. I count that as a restriction. And then I also look at social hostilities involving religion, such as terrorism, religion-related terrorism, hate crimes, sectarian violence, even religion-related war, crimes against women because of their what they wear religiously. So these two broad measures I'd look at, and among the many different factors of government restrictions, I've looked at favoritism and found that when government highly favors one religion above others, that is the chief indicator of social violence involving religion. So some degrees of favoritism of religion don't show that relationship, but it's when the government picks one religion that it favors much more highly than others, then you see that. And an example of that is the Middle East and North Africa. During the time of Arab Spring, violence increased, and it continues to increase in the region. And that, to me, is not surprising from a data point of view, because 95% of the countries in the Middle East and North Africa have high favoritism of one religion above others. So I think that that's part of the cycle of violence in the region. So again, some favoritism could be benign, but it's that high degree that I find to be associated with negative outcomes.
Well, both Professor Grimm's answer and his data remind us that we may be a majority in one place, Mormons here in Provo, but no place else. And whatever religious tradition we belong to, even if we are a majority in our homes, there are a lot of places in the world where we are not. And Professor Durham and I, as we've been thinking about this together for the last 15 or 20 years, have really come to believe that if we are constantly aware of the legitimate needs of majorities, but primarily adopting the viewpoint of how are minority groups being treated where we are, this will help us in making progress in this area. I was speaking just last week to a congregation of Mormons here in Provo, and that was the message that I was delivering, is that when we are here, we need to be thinking about what life is like for minorities, because it's the right thing to do, but also because we're minorities. But it's true of all of us. Please join me in thanking our morning panel.